Good afternoon. My name is Sheila Armstrong, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober since December 15th, 1984. And I want to first of all thank the committee for inviting me. This is such an honor and a privilege, absolutely. And thank Mary Ellen for picking us up at the airport and taking us last night over here and just taking care of us. And today, Julie took us to lunch, rushed us over there. We ate in record time and got back here. And, you know, and it's been, I've had a great time. I want to thank the two women that I sponsor that came with me. They both did workshops this morning at 8:30 and 10:30, and one did Vicky Victim is Dead, and the other one was Keep It Simple. And they, and if you attended those workshops, they were just really, really great workshops. And I was pretty much, you know, I'm not a soft sponsor, but I was a little soft this morning, but don't get used to it. But anyway, but I was so touched with these two women who I've known where they've come from to get up and talk about the recovery and the principles in their lives today and their lives and trying to help others. And I think that that is just, I was real touched to see how far we've all come, and I love you too, and I thank you so much for, you know, coming with me. Well, oh, Mary, I just, I've met you before at the Pacific Group, and I just loved your talk. You gave a great AA talk, and you were one of the women ahead of me on the path, and to those women, I will always be eternally grateful that you keep going to those night meetings, that you haven't gotten so well that, you know, you don't show up anymore. And I'm so glad you show up, because if everybody had gone home and gotten wonderful, gotten a hymn and a baby, you know, what would I have done the night I walked in? It would have been empty, you know, except a lot of guys, you know. And so for the women, there was a woman named Elizabeth in my in the workshop I was at today, and she had 48 years. And I was, you know, I just love to see the women with that time. I need to see those women still coming to meetings. So you, and I said to her, you're my vision of what I want to do and how to do this, and I need to see them. And I was so grateful that someone with that much time is still doing the deal. And so I just want to thank you all for just letting me be here. I could just sit down right now. I've done. We're done. my home group is called the Phoenix Group in Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma. We're at 227 Main Street. We're a storefront. Everybody in town knows what it is. We're just right out there in the middle of it, you know. And there's some alcoholics that say, well, we're out here in front of God and everybody. I'm like no one ever knew you were an alcoholic. Okay. Might be okay they see you at an AA meeting, you know. My sponsor is Peg Martin. She lives in Bellevue, Nebraska. She's got 36 years of sobriety. I go to my committed meetings are on Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday nights, unless I'm somewhere like Atlanta, Georgia. And I have a commitment in my home group, and I hope to always do. I hope to always do that. If I can't make a meeting, if I'm sick or dead, I call someone and I let them know. I call two or three women that I sponsor to let them know that I'm not coming. And I was taught that early on, because I'm the kind of person that how I got to, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it'd be like, well, are you going to go to coffee? Well, yeah. And then on the way there, I changed my mind, you know. You know, I never kept a commitment doing anything. I wasn't committed or responsible or accountable to anything. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'm on time to work, I'm early to work, I'm usually there. And those are the things how this program has affected every area of other area of my life. I was born in Oklahoma. I was born to two normal alcoholic parents, you know. They couldn't help themselves. They just were. They got divorced before I ever remembered they were married. I lived with my mother until I was 7 years old, and one day the social workers came and got us and put us in a foster home, and my father got wind of it in California, and I had never really, don't really remember my father at that point because they divorced before I remembered they were married. I have a younger brother. He's 13 months younger than I am. My father came to Oklahoma and got custody of my brother and I would not see my mother again until I was 19 years old, and that's alcoholism. That is the disease of alcoholism, and that's just the way it is. My father walked into the foster home we lived in. We were placed in a foster home at that time, and we were in this foster home, and he walked in the door, and he had a Thumbelina doll in one hand and a mitt in the other, and he said, "Hi, I'm Dad." And my dad had this big, booming voice, and he was big. Well, he looked big at seven, but when I was seven, but he's a big man, and I just didn't like him, you know. I mean, my brother cried because he'd always wanted a dad, but I just didn't like him. He wasn't Mom. He didn't really do anything wrong. He just was the wrong one, you know. From what I've learned over the years, I was a mama's girl. I adored my mother. I followed her everywhere as a child, and that's just a sad thing, you know. It's just, there's just is, and so... we went to live in California. My dad had married a nice Mexican lady. About 450,000 relatives picked us up at the airport, and they were pinching and hugging and everything, you know. And I liked them. They were so neat, you know. And it was fiesta, you know. So they had a party, and everybody fought and drank and ate tamales. And we had so much fun, and I loved that family. It was exciting. My tío Mondo would get in. He had a Lincoln Continental. You know, and he would go real fast on the freeways. He was my hero. He was a bad drunk. And, you know, I love that. I love alcoholics, you know. They sing and dance and fight, and they're great. And so, unfortunately, that marriage did not last. She did not have Al-Anon. She didn't understand. My father was an alcoholic, and he was in the last stages of his, he was in a bad, bad way. He was in the last stages of what would be his last drinking days. I woke up one morning and my dad said she went to go visit your uncle who wasn't feeling well, and I wouldn't see her again until I was 18 years old. And that's alcoholism. We went to Arizona at that time to live with my aunt and uncle, and what happened to me, and it would change my life forever, and I had no idea it would, was that... my father, when I was 10 years old, became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I didn't think it was such a big deal back then. It's a pretty big deal now, but it wasn't such a big deal back then. I just thought, that's nice for you. And so he had a sponsor, and his sponsor was last night's speaker, same sponsor, and his name is Clancy. And my father had a lot of problems. He was about to go to prison for embezzlement, and he was in big trouble, and he and his sponsor sat down and talked, and they came to the conclusion that, yes, that his children should come back to L.A., but that we would have to go live in another foster home. And I know that was a hard decision, but, you know, my aunt and uncle couldn't take care of us forever, so we did. And we came back to Los Angeles, and we were placed in a foster home. My father was living in a 12-step house. Now, this is not with a pool or jacuzzi or anything. It was like... It was an awful place, and it was like cots and men trying to sober up, and he would jump on a plumbing truck and go for like 75 cents an hour and go work, and that's how my father sobered up. We went and visited him first, and then we went down to McLaren Hall, which is in downtown Los Angeles, and we were placed in a foster home. And we got to this foster home, and it was a black foster home, and my foster mother and her son and her husband were there, and you know, we were supposed to only stay there a couple of weeks, I guess, so they could find a white foster home. And we ended up living there 3.5 years, and it was a wonderful experience. And they were so, she was like a mom to me. We called her Mom. And my foster father was, you know, he was so quiet, but she loved kids, so more kids kept coming to the house, you know. And the little Indian boy came to live there, Myron, and then a little Mexican girl, Hilda. And so I always say this, we would sit around the table at lunchtime and it looked like a meeting of the Junior United Nations, you know. We did not know color. We didn't know, I mean, I didn't know I was white for a long time after that, you know. Nor did I care, you know. And And it was summertime when we lived there, and it was like we just loved each other, and there was so much love in that home. And she had the most beautiful bedroom. I'd really always shared a room with my brother, and they had like boy Batman sheets and stuff, and I had like white and pink frilly. It was beautiful, the most a canopy bed, and she was just an incredible woman. And one day I said, "Why do you keep kids?" And she said, "Well, all my life I was a foster child, and I decided when I got older that someday I would take care of kids and be a foster mother." And so she gave back what was given. She had her own way, and I'm so grateful to people like that in my life. I had a lot of neat people that took good care of my brother and I, and I'm very, very grateful to that. Instead of, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like self-pity city. I mean, I was. I felt so bad, and my cousin one time said to me, one of my step-cousins, she said, "You know, Sheila, we felt kind of bad. You did have a bad life, but you felt so sorry for yourself. Nobody else could, you know?" And it was true. I just reeked of self-pity. It was like you couldn't even have fun with it, you know? And so, you know, that's the kind of person I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it wasn't very nice. But we lived in this foster home, and it was kind of normal. It was like a normal life, except there was prejudice. And we lived in what is now called South Central Los Angeles, and we'd go to school, and I'd come home, and I'd go, "What is a honky?" And she'd say, "Well," and she would explain it, and then at the end of it, she'd say, "Sheila, really, that's ignorance. That's ignorance." And I'd say, "Yeah, you're right, you know," and she said, "You know, don't worry." And then I'd come home with another name, and she would try to explain the world, and it was like, it was sad because we didn't have that in our world, in our home. We didn't have that there. And I said, "Well, why can't everyone just be like us in the house?" And she said, "Wouldn't it be nice, you know?" And but I love that time in my life. It was probably one of the normal times in my life. My dad met a nice lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. They got married. He had two kids. She had two kids. And then we got together. It was not the Brady Bunch, let me tell you what. And they were trying to get sober and try to do the right thing, and they were both pretty nuts, and so were their children. We were all nuts. And, you know, I was so needy at this point. I really wanted someone, you know, love me, please, you know, and I'm so needy. And she had a son who was dying of cystic fibrosis, and I don't know if you know what that is, but it's a disease that takes children. It takes children. She had already had a child that died of this disease. She has another child dying of this disease, and I'm this needy, you know, pre-alcoholic. And she did the very best she could. She absolutely did. And I just was so needy, and she was trying to, you know, and I didn't really realize how much, you know, what she was going through until I did an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous and looked at her from her perspective. This woman was trying to take care of another child that was going to, that eventually would die. And he was a sweet young boy. But all I thought about was me, and, you know, why isn't anyone loving me? And so they got divorced, and I went down the street to live with her sister, my brother and I did. And so I've had drinks up to this point, like a sipper and, you know, this and that, but I haven't had my first drunk. Boy, I sure can use one, and I'm about to have it. And, you know, because I remember drinking. If somebody says my first drink, was 4, I think, or 5. I remember my mother, I used to sip out of her beer all the time. But I don't even remember getting buzzed over it. I danced a lot, but I didn't remember getting buzzed. Maybe I was buzzed. I don't know. But anyway, my first drunk that I really remember is this guy asked me to the prom. He goes, "You don't have a date, and I don't have a date." And everybody was going, and I was a sophomore, and you could go to the junior-senior prom if you were a sophomore girl. And he said, "You don't have a date, and I don't have a date. You want to go?" And I go, "Oh, yeah, how romantic." So we go to the prom. I said, "Okay, my aunt is so sweet that I live down the street from." She said, "You know," she said, "let's go get your dress." So we go to get the dress, you know. She wanted to make it really, really special, not all her children or anything, just she and I, like one-on-one. It was kind of neat, you know. And so we go, and I pick out this low-cut yellow dress and tight, and she picks out this giant dress. I mean, it was big. It had these giant green flowers all over it. And it had one of those accordion neck things with a little ruffle right here. You know, it's like, oh my gosh. And it billowed, and it just was big. And it was green. And I hated that dress the minute I saw it. My eyes were, oh. But see, I'm kind of in trouble already. I'm smoking cigarettes. I'm hanging out with, you know, kind of some hoodlum, kind of cute guys. And I'm just pushing the envelope. I'm not coming home on time. I'm just doing a few little, you know, little fun things. And I've been doing a little few too many, and it's time for me to do something nice. I'm the type of alcoholic that I'll push you, and right when you're about to be done with me, I'll do something really wonderful, and you fall in love with me, and you care, oh, I'm wonderful. I'm one of those, I make people crazy alcoholics. And so it was time for me to do something really nice, so I thought, well, I'll get this dress. So she said, okay. So then she says, will you go to my hairdresser? And I thought about it, and hindsight's 20/20. You know, I think about that today, and her daughters weren't going to the hairdresser. What was I thinking? But I said, yes, I'll go. And back then it was the 70s. It was, you know, mid to late 70s, and everybody wore their hair long and straight, maybe curled at the ends on a, like, real good occasion. And so, but I went to this hairdresser, and I thought, how bad can this be? And she said, how would you like hair? And I said, oh, a little up and the rest down. Well, my hair came out this big. And it kind of kept going like a football, you know. And she kept putting it up and ratting, and, you know, I had hairpins forever in my hair. It took me days to get them out, and I was under the dryer for a couple of weeks, you know, and my ears were so, the top of my ears are still not quite right, I'm sure, and it was just a bad experience all the way around. So then my aunt comes running in the salon, you know, and she goes, oh, your hair looks so beautiful. That's exactly how she said it. And she goes, here, and she's got this baby's breath, so they're putting this yellow and white baby's breath in my hair. I mean, let's add insult to injury. And I mean, I was just like mortified at myself. I'm 15 years old, and I'm nuts, and I'm who I am anyway, and I'm 15 with all these emotions. I'm crazy. So I get, you know, me and my hair go out to the car. I get in. We get home. I put on the giant green dress, and I'm a bush in bloom. You know, I'm like, hello, looking good. So my date arrives, and 3 days before the prom, my date decides to bite the head off of a live frog. Yeah, you got a visual? A live frog, and he bit the head off and spit it out in front of everybody at school. I didn't get to watch the blessed event, but I heard lots about it, and everybody says, oh, the guy you're going to the prom with just bit the head off a live frog. And I thought, can anything ever go right just once? So he comes to my house, and my dad comes from down the street, and my foster parents come, and it was really neat. And there are times I come home from cheerleading practice, and we drive, you know, past, and my dad be watering the lawn. I'd wave, he'd wave back, and I go, who's that? And I go, that's my dad. And they go, your dad lives down the street from you? And I go, yeah, doesn't yours? You know, it was like the abnormal became normal, as the big book talks about. It just felt right, him living down the street, and we got along better. Let me tell you what, it kind of works, you know, in our life it did. And so my dad came from down the street, and he came in, and you know, he doesn't have the right car. You know, he doesn't even have the right car, because, you know, everybody else borrowed, like, you know, a nice car from grandma or their parents and stuff. And he has this, he has a Dodge Dart. And it pushed a button and it would start. He told me, it's a classic. Well, it is now, it was just old then. And I was really mad about it. And so he looked bad. He just wasn't, it wasn't right. You know how I have this vision for me, what should be going on, and that wasn't it. And so he comes in the house and everything, and my little cousin comes in and goes, are you the guy that bit the head off a live frog? Because he was like a, you know, famous to my cousin. And he goes, well, yeah, you know, my dad, his eyes like roll up in his head, and he goes, what? You know, and he's got this big voice, and I go, let's get out of here. So we get out of here, and he's got champagne in the car. And he's got those little plastic glasses, you know, the ones where the thing never stays on the bottom. You're trying to look real elegant, and that thing keeps falling up. So he couldn't even have glass. Okay, we're at the prom here, guy. You know, no. So we're sipping a little, you know, champagne, and I think, you know, I'm not going to get drunk. This is, you know, because I know about AA. My dad's been in AA several years by now, by 5 years. And I met a lot of you people. I loved you. I babysat your kids. Is that right? And so, and I babysat their children. I knew about AA and everything. And I kind of thought about alcoholism, and I thought, I'm not going to get drunk. This is such a little tiny glass, you know. And we went to the prom, and nothing happened. We went to the after parties, and the after parties were great. People were making me drinks, like, here, have a tequila sunrise. So I'd pretend to look at the sunrise. It was really fun. And then they, you know, a greyhound, and I go, oh, what's that? And they made me, and you know, about 150 of those puppies. And I'll tell you what happened. My hair got long and straight, Those flowers flew off my dress, and frog lips started looking really good. Yes. That kind of good, you know, and he was wonderful. I thought, oh, what a great date, you know. And right before I went into a blackout, and because I drank so much that I blacked out, I passed out, and I threw up. And one of the things I remember, I don't remember much about this night, but one of the things I do remember is being on all fours throwing up in this bush tree thing and him standing there handing me a cert. And I thought, this is not my idea of the prom, you know. It's like it's just not quite working out. You know, and that's my drinking. What happened for me, and Clancy talks about the disease of perception, is that nothing had changed, but everything changed. Nothing really had changed except I put alcohol in me and my whole perception of reality changed. It changed what was really going on. Nothing had changed. My hair was still just as big. Those flowers were on that dress and he had still bitten the head off a live frog. However, it seemed like it was different or it was okay or it didn't matter. And I just felt like I took the biggest deep breath of my life. I loved the way alcohol made me feel. It was wonderful. You know, when I was 16 years old, I was still living with my aunt. When I was 16 years old, I got a call that my foster sister, Hilda, who I absolutely adored, had killed herself, you know, and that was a horrible thing to experience. And she had taken a shotgun and blew her stomach out. And she did not want to live. The difference between she and I really believe this, is that she had not found alcohol and I had at 15. She had not drank as far as I knew. Maybe she had drank, maybe she had lived a little longer to get here. I think sometimes that's what my experience is. I really loved her, and it was a sad, sad thing. I got through high school, and I got out of high school, and I started looking for my mother. I was 19 years old, and I find my mother. And I go back to Texas, where my mother was living, and she was living in Texas. And, you know, I thought my mother was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. My mother was a registered nurse. She was a surgical nurse. She wore white, and then back in those days, they had the cap, and she was elegant. She was beautiful. She'd come to my kindergarten, and I remember feeling proud that she was my mom. You know, I loved her. And when I went back to Texas when I was 19 years old, because I always thought my whole life, if I was just with my mom, everything would be all right. If I could just be with my mom, everything would be all right. And she was old. She looked like she was 80 years old. She's only in her late 40s. And she looked so bad. And she lived in this Social Security building. And the people there were all in their 60s and 70s. And they were taking care of her. She had lost an eye from drinking, from a fungus that she had gotten from drinking. You know, she could hardly walk. She was real hobbly. And she was very, very ill. And that's what it talks about in the big book, that women go down so very fast. And she wasn't that beautiful lady that I remember anymore. And it was just like a nightmare trip. So I went back to California and I thought, this was a horrible experience. And so I set out to just go crazy. I went as a waitress, and I ended up in a field one night in a blackout. And I woke up and I thought, I'm in this, you know, I didn't know how I got there. I was kind of worried about being in a field alone, not knowing how I got there. And then that Saturday night, my father was getting his 10-year AA birthday chip at his home group, Pacific Group, so his cake. So I went to go see him do that, and I heard a lady speak, and I really identified with her. And then I called this other lady named Sharon Barker, and she had just gotten her mouth unwired. She had her mouth wired shut her first year sober, and she had just gotten her mouth unwired, which was good, lucky for me. And we visited, and I told her I thought I might have a problem. And when I talked to her, and she said, yeah. And then so I started going to the Pacific Group. I went to the Pacific Group for 9 months, and I did everything that I was asked to do, except I didn't read the book. You know, I did everything. I looked really busy, but I wasn't taking right action. I was doing lots of activity, and I didn't really think, really, really in my heart, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I had a lot of bad luck, and I thought it was probably my childhood fault, and that was probably about it. I thought maybe I had like a field problem. You know, I'm waking up in fields. I kind of wake up in things like that. But, you know, it's a location problem. It'll be all right now. You know, I got this under control. And so I left Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had an 8-year slip. You know, I did not come back for 8 years. And I'm glad that I had to do what I had to do. In those 8 years, I experienced pitiful, incomprehensible, and demoralization. And just go to the depths where women have to go, and men. But women alcoholics seem to come in with no dignity whatsoever, and I sold everything, and I sold my soul, and I sold my dignity for alcohol and drugs. I met a him. He owned a bar, free beer and pool for the rest of my life. I do, and I married him. He was a big man. He looked like Paul Bunyan. He had a big red beard, and we used to fight a lot. You know, it's just fuss and fight. And then he was huge. I mean, I'm not a big girl, and I would just like knock him out. You know, I would just want to fight all the time when I was drunk. And he was an Irishman, you know, and he was, you know, he was just flirty and cute, and all the girls liked him. And I was like, but you're married to me. And so we weren't getting along, and I got a call that my mother was very, very ill in Texas. So I went to Texas and walked in her room. The nurse was trying to be so kind. She said, you know, she's in a coma and she's very, very, very sick. So I said, you know, I've been doing stuff alone all my life. I've been alone most of my life. I think I can handle this. And that's where I'd become a real tough girl, and I didn't need anybody, and anybody that was kind to me, I mistook for weakness. And so I walked in that room, and my mother had tubes going all through her, and she was bloated and yellow. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody die of alcoholism, but it's an awful thing to see. My mother was in a coma. She didn't even know I was there, and I read to her, and I talked to her, and the nurse said, you know, the last thing to go is the hearing, and maybe, just maybe, she will hear you. And so I did, and I sat through the night, and I thought, and all that stuff was coming through in my head. I had stuff going on, and all those thoughts, and my aunt shows up with, and that was my mother's sister, and she was talking about things I'd done when I was a little girl, and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, where did y'all go? You know, I've got this horrible stuff, no program. And all I can think of is getting down to my mother's house, which was down the street from the hospital, to get something to drink. I wonder, I was going to go run through her apartment to find out where her booze was, because I really wanted to drink, and that's what I'm there for. My mother stayed in this coma through the night, and the next day when I was talking to her sisters, we were sitting out in the lobby, and the nurse comes out and says, you need to come in here right now. And I thought, well, this is it. Walk in the room, my mother was sitting up, and she said, will you forgive me? And I said, yes. And I am so grateful that I said that. My mother knew she was dying. She said, I could hear you, but I couldn't talk to you. And she knew she was dying. And I learned about forgiveness in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will always be grateful for that. You taught me how to forgive. You showed me how to do it, and you told me to take actions that went against everything that I believed in. When I got sober, I had no relationship with my father. We fought and fought and fought. I would go months at a time and not tell my dad where I was. He wouldn't know where I was because I was embarrassed of where I was. I was sleeping on couches of men, strange men's houses, and doing the things that I do when I drink. And I didn't want him to know a lot of times of the things I was doing. I divorced. I came back. I buried my mother. My dad helped me bury my mom with my brother, and came back, and I just went on reckless abandon. I just drank and used until I couldn't do it anymore. And I met another him. I divorced that him, met another him a couple of years later. And I had this, I 8 months pregnant, and he left. And that would be 17 years this week that he left. And I was alone. And I remember thinking, what is wrong with me? What's so wrong with me? No one ever seems to stay. And what was wrong with me was me and alcoholism. I had this baby. I was absolutely devastated. I had this beautiful baby boy, and I immediately loved him. I had bonding, or whatever you want to call it, but he was mine, and he's what I always wanted. And I thought, I'll be a good mom now. I drank and used drugs when I was pregnant, and it's not a pretty part of my story. It's a bad part of my story, but it's part of my story, and I will always share it, because women shared that with me. And it helped me get through a lot of stuff. He was born healthy. He was a sweet little baby, and I was going to be the best mom. I was going to learn to cook, bake cookies. I was going to learn to do everything you ever did as a mom. And I meant to my soul, I wanted to be the best mom. And I know this today because of my experience, that no matter how much I love that baby, the love I had for him could not keep me sober alone. And then when I got here and I looked at that in an inventory, I realized my mother probably loved me a whole lot too. And that's what I've gotten from this, is that you all have helped me so much. The steps are so magnificent, and the actions that I had to take to get there. And those are the things that happened for me with healing. I had this baby, and he fixed me for about 2.5 weeks. And I started drinking and using again, running and gunning, going crazy. I met a Marine, moved down to Oceanside, California. I figured, well, heck, they take care of the entire United States. Surely he can help me. Did not work. I was even too much for the Marines, you know. He left me and he ran off with a whack or a wave, and we ended up moving. I know, hello. Can you believe it? I ended up moving in with this hairdresser. I was a manicurist as well and a cocktail waitress. We ended up moving in with her. She let us sleep on the floor. And she caught me coming in one night real late, and she would watch Brad, and I would pretend to be at work, and I would be at work for a while, and then I'd stay out all night drinking, and I'd come in about 5-6 in the morning, pretend to sleep for an hour, and then I'd act like I'd been home most of the night, waking up at the house. I don't know, I never slept. I was on a lot of amphetamines and things like that, and snorting a lot of things and drinking all the time, and I was very, very ill from drinking. And she caught me coming in one night, and she said, "You're sick, you have sores on you, one of your eyes is so dilated, I think you're having a stroke." She said, "You have got to call somebody. I know your mother's dead. You need to call your father." I hadn't talked to my dad in a very long time, and so I called him, and I said, you know, his wife answered. He was married to a nice lady named Vinoy. She's a black belt Al-Anon. When it's the end, do not call the black belt Al-Anon lady. They will do something. And I'll be forever grateful. I just told her, I said, you know, I said, my dad, I said, I'm gonna put Brad in a foster home, and I'm gonna walk the streets because I can't live this way anymore. And she said, "Well, hold on, your dad's doing a fifth step. I'm gonna have him call you back." I said, "Okay." He called me back, and what did I do? I went and got drunk. I mean, that was like a big admission. I was sick to my stomach after I said that. I hung the phone up and went and got drunk. The next day he called, and once circumstances led that we got together and talked, and he gave me a one-way, non-cashable, non-refundable, I checked ticket to Oklahoma. You know, that's what he did. My father did not put me in a treatment center. He did not pay my rent. He did not give me an apartment. He didn't see how much money I needed. He gave me a one-way ticket to Oklahoma, non-cashable, non-refundable, you know, really, because I checked and I was going to cash it in. My father invented tough love along with Clancy. They got together with their kids, I think, on that one. I really do. And so I moved to California with this, to Oklahoma with this baby, and I thought my life was over. Oklahoma, my God, I'm a beach girl. Hello, what have I done? I'm really sick. And I thought, you've really done it this time. I remember getting on the plane, being so mad at myself. What have I done? And so I got on this plane with this baby, and I was in a blackout because I started drinking, and by the time I remember, we landed in Tulsa, and they said, you know, this is Tulsa, and we'll be, you know, stay here, and we're on our way to Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City was where I would have to get off the plane. I thought, I better start drinking some coffee because, you know, the AA people are picking me up. So anyway, my dad did not pick me up from the airport because that's the kind of relationship we had. My father, he didn't know what to say to me or do, and he sent his wife, and she and another Al-Anon. He sends two Al-Anons to pick me up. That was really chicken. Anyway. So he did, and they picked me up, and they were really kind to me, and I was just a mess. I was just a mess. And we got to my dad's house, and we hi, how are you doing? Fine. This is your grandson. It was just awful. You know, it was just awful. And I lived there for a while, and then I moved out and found the same kind of people. I thought, you know, if I get to Oklahoma and change locations, that'll be different. You know, I'm in a beach crazy, the jet set, crazy, nutty life. I'm going and drinking and going and just crazy life. So I go to Oklahoma. Nothing happens in Oklahoma. You know, I thought maybe I'd marry some old boy, we raised chickens or something, but that did not happen. Because birds of a feather flock together. I found the same kind of people doing the same kind of things in Oklahoma. And I And I went into a blackout one night. I put my son Brad to bed next to me. We shared a big bed and put him down to bed. We had a party at my apartment, and the girls that lived with me there, my roommates, and I got really, really drunk, and I went into a blackout, and I passed out. The next morning I woke up. I had mud all over me. I hadn't changed my clothes, and my son wasn't in bed next to me, and I went into my roommates' rooms. I couldn't find him. He was not in either room, and I thought, my God, he's gone outside and froze to death. It was December 15th, 1984, and it's very, very cold in Oklahoma. On December 15th, 1984, it was a very, very cold day, and I thought, my God, he's gone outside and froze to death. And I'd heard about babies, these things happening in the Midwest. I'd lived in California most of my life. I'd never really heard it there, and I was frightened, and I was crying, and my roommate got up and said, what's wrong with you, and what were you doing last night, and you were crazy, and, you know, those questions they ask you. And I said, I can't find Bradford. And she said, he's right here. And I never want to forget this. And he was in these little pajamas with the feet in them. And he was walking down the hall. And he was, you know, he was 20 months old. And he said, Mom. And it was like I had a moment of clarity. I knew that this was not my mom's fault. This was not my father's fault. This was my fault. I was doing this to my child. And it was time for me to look at me. And I said something to the effect of, Mommy's going to get help. And I hugged him and hugged him. And luckily, I'd gone to some Al-Anon meetings, because in my dad's house, you have to go to something while you live there. I'm not stupid. So I went to some Al-Anon meetings, you know, and the alcoholic women on the open, I'd go to open Friday night speaker or Saturday night speaker meetings, and the alcoholic women, you know, we can spot each other, and they would give me their cards, and they'd give me, you know, their phone numbers. And I called this one lady named Mary, and she wasn't home, but her husband was. And he said, you know, I know a lot more about you, probably a little bit more about you than I really should. And he said, Sheila, I know your dad so well. He said, why don't you, he goes, get your over here. And I did, and I sat down at his kitchen table, and he 12-stepped me with a big book and a cup of coffee at a kitchen table. And he told me, he said, you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. And he said, and you don't ever have to feel this way again if you don't want to. And he said, and everything is going to be all right. And for some reason, I heard that. And I'm always going to be so grateful to him to take the time that he answered his phone on a Saturday morning, that he didn't have his answer machine on or caller ID or whatever. You know, he just picked up his phone. Because I don't know if I'd have called again. Maybe I would have. I don't know if I'd have called again. And so his wife came home, and she finished the job. And so then he said, you know, you need to go to our group tonight. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, that's my dad's group. I love what Bob Darrell says. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. He said, you know, alcoholics come in, we lose everything, we lose cars, we have no car, we have no home, we have no nothing. And the first thing we get back is our opinion, you know. So I'm like desperate. It's 20 minutes later, and I'm like, well, I don't know if I need to go to that group. Oh, you know, I'm so crazy. So I said, well, you know, that's Dad's group, and I need my own AA, and I want to be my own person. And I went into that thing. Yawn. So they said, well, Sheila, you need to go somewhere, and that's a really good group, and it's a structured group, and that's what you need. You have no discipline, you have no structure in your life, and you need someone to help you on this path. And I said, okay. So that night I started thinking, maybe I made a little bit, I want a drink is what it is. I want a drink, and that's what's really going on. And I think, well, maybe I made a big deal about this AA, going back to AA. God, I wasn't that bad of a black. I only lost my child. You know, I mean, it's just crazy, you know, and I'm trying to justify. And my roommates, who are drinkers, I mean, they were drinking buddies, they said, are you going to that A&A tonight? And I said, you know, I don't have a babysitter. And they said, we'll babysit. Now, when you're drinking buddies or want to watch a child to go to the AA meeting, you might want to go, you know? It's true. You might want to look at your drinking. Okay. So I went. So I got in the car to go to my meeting, my own meeting, and I couldn't find one because I'd never been to another group. I didn't know where it was, so I had to go to my dad's group. Isn't that funny? I go, well, where is it? I don't know where another meeting is, so I've never been to another group. So I went to the meeting, and my father was in the meeting, and he was sitting in the, he was in the front. He saw me, and we were sitting down in our group today, and that group then, it was, you know, are there any newcomers within their first 30 days of sobriety? Please raise your hand, not to embarrass you, but so that we may get to know you. And I did not want to raise my hand, but you know how the people, you know, they're watching you, you know? You know? They're looking right at you, and I'm like, I think I'm going to kill myself right here in front of you. So I go, okay, so I raise my hand. I kind of scratched my head, actually, and did this. So willing. And my dad caught a glimpse of it, and he got called on. It was 30 minutes participation, and he got called on to participate, and he said, I saw my daughter raise her hand back there, and he said, of all the Christmas presents in the world, that one's the best. He said, I hope that she stays here and finds this way of life. And I have. And, you know, it's been a wonderful journey. And there's been some of the most incredible times I've ever had in my life, and there's been some of the saddest times I've ever had in my life. Just because I get sober doesn't mean it's going to be wonderful. I met a man in AA. I got a sponsor. I worked two jobs. I had no car. I got arrested at 90 days sober. I was ready. I'm like, what is wrong with me? You know, I can't even do AA right, you know? I mean, like, people were getting arrested before they got sober, not after. And and I had to get through that. And then I had to get a ride to the daycare. Then I get a ride to my first job. Then I get a ride to home, and then to the daycare, and then back to another daycare, and then to my second job, and then after the job I'd get to a meeting, you know. And I did that, but I did that, and you taught me how to do that. And I would wake up some morning and think, I can't do this today. And my sponsor would say, let's just go to your first job. Let's go to daycare and your first job, and then we'll see what happens later. Maybe you can just call in sick your second job. Well, I'd get going and I could be okay, you know. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me rides. You know, but I had to, she wouldn't let me just call one person and keep using people over and over. And I was a manicurist, so I would trade gas money and stuff for manicures. I'd do manicures on them, or I'd clean their closet. You know, I would have to do something for someone else so that it wasn't just take, take, take. And my first sponsor taught me that. I went to lots of meetings, and I was taught to get there early, and I still do today, and to shake hands and be a greeter and go the extra mile. And she said, Sheila, you'll get as much out of Alcoholics Anonymous as you put into it. It'll all be up to you. If you want a lot, you give a lot. If you want a little bit, just then give a little bit. One of the things that happened was I met a nice man in Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't in AA. I was. He wasn't. I was in AA. He's a normie. Well, he used to be. He said he's not anymore. He's kind of conceded to that. He said, well, I used to be normal. I said, well, that was a long time ago. And he's a nice, normal guy, you know. He's got alcoholics all around him, but he's not an alcoholic. And we got married, and my son Brad just adored him. And Brad was 7 when we got married, and Dave adopted him. And I got pregnant right away. I found out I was pregnant. And in my 6th month of pregnancy, I found out I was pregnant with twins. And I felt doubly blessed. It was a really neat, that was a neat moment in my life. It still is a neat moment, even though things didn't work out right. It will still always be a very happy time for me thinking that. We found out one was a boy, and I didn't want to know the other one because I was hoping it was a girl, and I wanted to be surprised. And in my 7th month, we started having some problems, and they said that there was a little girl, and that she found out she was a little girl, and that she was sick. And they said, Sheila, we don't think she's going to live. And I said, you got to be kidding, you know. And it was on a Friday, and we were going to this expert on a Monday, and I'm carrying these, I'm big, and I've got these babies. And I remember praying Sunday night, going, God, will you please take care of my little girl? I remember saying that prayer. And the next day we went to the specialist, and he looked over at me, and he said, oh, I'm so sorry she didn't make it through the weekend. And I thought my heart would break. And I said, well, what do we do from here? And he said, well, we just take it a day at a time. I said, well, I can do that. And so I had to carry both those babies until the end of the pregnancy, which I had Daniel 1 month early, and he was born, but he was healthy, and he was, you know, he had a little breathing problem, but nothing now. I mean, he's fine. And he's my love. I just love him. And I heard a tape of Norm Alpe, who was a great AA man and a great speaker, but a great AA, and he talked about the same kind of thing. And he said, what I have to do is I have to look at what's left and not what I lost. You know, and I'm driving down the street and I was thinking about that. He said, I just look at what's left and not what I lost. And that's what I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always try to look at what's left, not what I lost. And so I'm blessed that we even have Daniel. And I had this great little guy, and he's a sweetie. I'll tell you about my boys real quick. That little boy that was in those little jammies is 16 years old, and he drives a little red truck, and his life is everything I hoped it would be the day he was born. But I had no idea I could get there from here. I had no idea I could be here from that horrible place that we started. And I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely. Absolutely, Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has not hurt my children. Going to tons of meetings and sponsoring women and doing the things that I do, and I want to tell you, it has not hurt my children at all. Monday night... Monday night, my oldest, my son, my Brad, he comes to the meeting. He's always hanging out, coming, hi. He just drives by and he pulls in, you know. And he comes to the meeting, he goes, Mom, I want to go to Sonic with you. And I go, oh, Brad, I got to talk to a couple of girls. He goes, well, I could do something while you're doing that. I go, well, take Leah home to the homeless shelter and come on back. He said, okay. And he does, you know. I mean, he just does, okay, you know. And so he does, and he comes back here. You know, and I go, yeah, well, you know, because there was a couple girls I needed to visit, and we went to Sonic, and we just talked about his semi-formal and just his life, you know. And he goes, I just missed you. I just wanted to hang out with you, you know. And God, I just love him. He had some problems in school when he was younger. He was having some learning problems, and you know. And I, of course, I hated myself. I just hated myself. It's all my fault. It was, probably. You know, what am I going to say? It's not my fault. And I felt so guilty. And so many women, you know, were so... They said, Sheila, you know, God takes care of everything. And he's got a plan for Brad, too, you know. And he took a practice SAT test or ACT, one of those... I never took them, so I don't know what they're called. And they're practice ones they take in school. They're the real thing, but they do them, you know, let them practice them. And he had got a 31 on it. And the highest you can get is 35. You know, and he's got a 3.0 average. And he's smart. He's really smart. And I called my stepmom, Vinoy. That's the grandmother that he's always known. And he said, Nama, guess what? I got a 31 on my ACT. And da, 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 da. She was all excited. She says, well, honey, where are you going to go? Harvard? Yale? He goes, well, Grandma, I'm a Sooner. You know, and she goes, oh, your grandfather's won. You know, because my dad loved Oklahoma so much, you know, and they would fight about it because she's from Texas. And it was just a sweet moment, you know. It was just a sweet moment. I'm going to tell one more story and then I'm going to sit down. I got these braces on. I have these braces. And this is, my dad always wanted me to have braces, and he never really could afford it. A year before he died, my father died 3 years ago of cancer, and a year before he died, before we even knew he was sick, he said, I always feel so bad I never got your braces, honey. And I said, well, Dad, I said, you know, it's on the list. You know, Dave and I'm a big girl now, and Dave and I have it. I'm married, and we can get those things. And he said, yeah, but I just, gosh, there's some of the things I wish I'd done, you know. I said, well, Dad, you were kind of like trying to, you know, get us out of a foster home and raise us, you know. I said, you did fine. So he said, I know, and it just bugs me. And so this last April, I got these braces on. And I walk out of the different dentist office, and I look up to the sky, and I go, I got my braces on, you know. And then I start thinking, because that's what I do in my mind constantly. See, there's some other thinkers in here, and that's good. I don't ever want to be alone in my thinking. And so he said, my mind starts going, I wonder if he can really see my braces. Wonder if he's in heaven. I wonder if there's heaven. You know, and it's getting darker by the moment here, and it's spiraling downward. You know, all my belief in God, and it's just horrible. So I get in my car, and my husband got me a cell phone, and so I pick it up and I call a newcomer. Hi, what are you doing today? How's your day? I wanted to get out of me. I was like way sick in my head. It was getting darker and darker and darker up there. I was like getting into evolution theories, and you know, it's just, you know, I can go from getting my braces on to, you know, some sort of theological goof today. I was horrible. It's horrible. And I just hate to admit for all my friends here that I have that kind of mind, but maybe you'll identify. So anyway, so that Wednesday night, we take this meeting to this place called First Step, and I'd never been to this particular one. We went to First Step, and we were late, we got lost, and it's out in the woods somewhere, and they gave us the wrong directions. They gave us directions to the men's facility, not the women's facility. So the girl said to me, the CDC coordinator, she said, look, we're 30 minutes late. I'll just call them, you know, tonight or tomorrow and tell her we got lost and we're terribly sorry we got wrong directions. I said, no, let's go back to the men's facility. We'll call over to the women's facility and we'll get directions from there. And at least they'll know we tried. And they said, well, we thought you might say something like that. So yeah, that's right. And so we get there and we're late, and we've only got 20 minutes left to the meeting. And we apologized. It was just an accident. And so she said, I said, why don't we were going to do step two. And I said, well, why don't we got four of us, we'll do a panel, 5 minutes each. And the girl shared, and then I shared, and I shared about it. You can do anything you want in your life. And I said, you know, I got braces this week. I'd always wanted braces as a kid, and you can have anything you want if you're willing to work for it and suit up and show up. And I said, you know, I hope my dad danced in heaven. And I looked across the room. The room was, there was like us up here and then a little bit of room, and then there was like the women were like this, and there were, you know, about 50 women there. And this woman straight across the room from me, she had this T-shirt on. I said, I stopped the meeting. I said, where did you get that shirt? She goes, out of the donation closet. And the girls around me are going, what's wrong with her, you know? And I said, will you stand up, please? And she stood up, and she was wearing my father's plumbing shirt. And I said, that's my dad's plumbing shirt you have on, by the way. And the room was pretty quiet. These girls were pretty spooked. Like, woo-woo. And I said, you know, I said, the strange thing about this is that that business, my father's been dead almost 3 years at that time. It's been dead almost 3 years, and it hasn't even been in business in 3 years. And when it was in business, it was in Los Angeles, California. It was not in Oklahoma. And one of the girls that Renee sponsors, Kara, was there, and she came up to me, and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, God's telling you that your dad saw your braces. I said, yeah. Good stuff. And I feel so badly that I doubt my God, and he loves me, and my dad's okay. I absolutely love my father. And it's like I heard a lady say, it's your fault. I was taught to take actions toward him. I had to bring him the paper every morning when I lived with him and hot tea and make water for his hot tea. And I hated doing those actions because I kind of thought he owed me amends. And I did. And I'm ashamed to say. And I kept doing those things, and we could talk about sports because I love sports. He gave me my love of sports, and we could talk about sports and the weather, and that was it. And I did those actions until I made amends to my father, and I did an eighth and a ninth step, and I made a ninth step amends to my father, and then I made living amends. And when I was pregnant with my second child, I asked my husband if we could tell him first because he was the last one to know I was pregnant with my first son. I was 5 months pregnant when I told him that I was pregnant with Brad, and I wanted him to know and be the first to know, and I made some sort of amends that way, and he was. I said, Daddy, you're the first to know, and you know, and I love you. And I would go to California and visit him, and when he was got sick, my heart broke, and I didn't want him to die. And he came outside. I was sitting on a porch, and it was, you know, right after he got diagnosed, and he was getting ready to die, and he was sick, and he came outside, and he said, are you okay, baby? And I said, no, Daddy, I'm not all right. I said, I can't imagine my life without you. I said, you know, we finally get it all together and you got to go. And he said, yeah. He said, my mission is up, Sheila. And he said, and I'm handing the baton to you. And he said, you get out there and you stay on the firing line of life and you take care of those women and help those alcoholics. And he said, it's your turn. And I know you'll do a good job and I love you. And I said, okay. Really, I thought, what an order. I can't go through with this. Thanks a lot, Dad. Great, you know. And I absolutely adored my father, and I love being in the room with people that were in his home group, and I always feel like he's kind of with me. And he loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was always my hero, you know, after I got sober, but he was always my example. My parent was always my example, and I hope I leave you with that. We are the example for our children, you know, and I want to be a good example. I want to be a good example because we don't know which one's going to need this. And I want to thank you for allowing me to talk here today, and I'm going to stay on the firing line of life, and I hope you are too.